From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, rising home values mean good news for some, but what if you're struggling to keep up with rising taxes?
We don't need to push them out. We need to help them be homeowners, and we need to help them be able to keep those homes.
Why parents should not be afraid to talk to teens about suicide.
One thing I would really like to emphasize here is talking about is never a trigger.
We look at minimum liquor prices in Michigan.
The thought is, if there is minimum pricing, we're not selling alcohol as a loss leader. It makes it just a little bit more difficult to get your hands on the product.
And gearing up for summer stock theater.
Every great actor did summer stock. I mean, I've heard stories, Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda, Tom Hanks, and they learn a lot. You really make your bones doing summer stock.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It wasn't all that long ago when for sale signs spread across Michigan yards like dandelions that just never went away. The housing market had crashed, and a lot of Michigan homeowners found themselves underwater. Well, times have changed for some Michiganders, and now sellers in some parts of our state have the advantage, as Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith discovered when she recently sold her home in a Grand Rapids neighborhood, winding up, in her words, feeling like some kind of gentrifying bandit. Lindsay Smith is here now, along with her Grand Rapids realtor, Michelle Gordon. It's great to have you both with us. Hey, Lindsay.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And welcome, Michelle.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Lindsay, here you are moving to Ann Arbor for a job change at Michigan Radio. And in that move, you discovered something very interesting when you went to sell your house. What did you find?
I mean, I feel like I found what I sort of knew was happening in my neighborhood, which was that people were not being able to afford to stay there, that prices of homes and also the price of rent were going up pretty dramatically. It's one of those stories where it hits you when it's your house. I mean, this is a known thing. It's just when it happens to you and your house, it's so much more personal. And I felt the need to put myself out there to sort of demonstrate or put a face to what one individual went through.
So going through and really seeing firsthand what the market boom in Grand Rapids is about. Michelle Gordon, how long has Grand Rapids housing market gotten hot? I guess I'm wondering when Grand Rapids was able to pull itself out of that great recession slump.
I've been selling for 15 years, and I came into the business when it was good, and it was what we would call quote-unquote normal. A fair amount of inventory would be about 3 to 4 months worth of inventory. I saw the crash, and then we went into the bank-owned era, which is how I met Lindsay. And then we had over 9 months of worth of inventory, and we've been rapidly dropping our inventory for the last 3 years, and now we're under 1 month.
Wow. Lindsay, tell us about your house and the neighborhood.
So my house is a kind of an interesting house because it's a new house in an old neighborhood. The housing stock around me was built 1900, roughly, right? The housing there is mostly single-family homes, and they're mostly, you know, somewhere between 75, I'd say, and like 100 years old. So my house being new makes it sort of unique. There was two houses on that property that were built around the same time as most of the rest of the neighborhood, but they were both raised throughout the decades. And this is the part thing about my house I didn't really write about, is they're kind of cookie cutter houses in a way. Like, they're cute. They're really cute. They're two-story houses. They're very simple, but they're cute. And you can see them when you drive around my neighborhood. I'm like, oh, there's my house. Oh, there's another one of my houses. You know, they're just like a different color. They have the same shed. They have, you know, the same front porch. So you can kind of spot these around the neighborhood. And it is interesting to me. I've sort of over the years looked up those houses and what they've sold for. And they just run just all kinds of different market prices depending on where they really land. I was floored to get the number that we got.
So first of all, you bought it in 2013 for how much?
For $65,000.
She bought it for $65,000, but you need to know that it was listed twice. They could not sell it, and the ball was in our court. So I think that's important to know.
And Lindsay, you've just sold your house for how much?
For $135,000.
So you got $70,000 more than you paid for that house.
Yeah.
in 3.5 years. Michelle, tell us what kind of buyer traffic and interest that you got for Lindsay's house.
Well, I feel really bad for Lindsay, but I thank her and her husband for going down this road. It's always inconvenient to sell your home, but I have never in 15 years experienced what I experienced with her home. I knew there would be interest. I knew there would be multiple offers. I don't know anybody that has received 49 offers on one property. But it was, I think it was heartbreaking more than exciting till the end.
Now, why do you say that, Michelle?
Because there's ways that we can look at the offer and the type of financing they're getting where we can tell if it's for sure a owner-occupied purchase agreement. If someone is putting 5 or 3% down, that would not be an investor property because they have to put down a minimum of 15 to 20% depending on their lender. So the majority of the offers offered either FHA or a minimal down payment. So I believe we said there was positively at least 43 of those that were owner-occupied for sure. And it was heartbreaking because normally I love multiple offers. I love the excitement. I live for that. But not so much when you know that these people are not going to go find another house. That, you know, some of them were living with family. Some of them had nowhere to live. Some of them were living in a one-room apartment. And I don't know when they're going to find another home.
Boy. So you were stunned by the offer. Was it because of this great house or was it because, by golly, there's nothing out there?
Combination of all above. It's bordering a very, very hot neighborhood. Yeah. And we didn't know if it was bordering enough. It's a what we would call an up-and-coming neighborhood for sure. It's newer construction, but it's the only newer construction within her few streets. And so we knew that was going to be a great draw. But I just had no idea. I mean, we got 10 offers. I was excited. We got 20 offers. I said, this is great. And then I had to cancel my day. The offers just kept coming in. And I think at one point I stopped making your spreadsheet.
You know, Michelle, looking, you know, from the outside looking in, like there is a lot to be happy about for you as a realtor. Lindsay and her husband get a mighty fine return on what they put into that house. Is that not something that you always want to try to get for your clients?
I'm lucky enough in this case to have a client that it's not all about the money. I know that her and her husband shed tears over this, making decisions. I know that I had to be the professional at the house, and I did not, but I went home and literally cried with my husband. He gets to hear all of that stuff. And so we're very excited. Don't get me wrong. I told them when they bought this house, if they kept it 5 years, they would double their money. So I was able to keep my promise. But so that was good. But I would have rather kept my promise in a different way.
Yeah. Lindsay, you wrote a reporter's notebook on this whole experience. And as you put it, I made out like some kind of gentrifying bandit. Tell us about why you wrote that.
Okay, so this is really kind of easy. I mean, I sort of started the open here by saying that I felt like this was something that was obviously happening in the neighborhood to me for a while, where people were getting pushed out. They just didn't have a place to live. But what really hit home with me, what made me decide that, or one of the things, I shouldn't say it's the only thing, but one of my next door neighbors' house was foreclosed on really late last year. She was removed from the house this month. So while I'm down the hill, you know, selling my house, making money for my family and everything, which is good, it broke my heart to see her and her family really struggle to get not only this, you know, elderly woman who had lived here for forever, but her sister lived in the home who had a disability. So it's going to be a lot of change for them. And I think, like, that's the thing that sort of pushed me to feel like this is a big deal. You know, I just felt like as a reporter, I have to talk about these things. And so while I obviously feel kind of vulnerable to write this piece, it was something that I just had to do.
Lindsay, what led you to choose the winner of this heated battle? And cash was, you know, you saw pictures of cash on a table saying, look, I can pay you. What led you to choose the winner, Lindsay?
For me, because the first time around, I did take advantage of a state program that you could get, I think it was a no interest or a low interest loan for a down payment through MSHTA. this time around, you know, I didn't have that luxury. And so whatever I made off this house is what I had for a down payment. And I got to say, I'm moving from Grand Rapids, which is a hot housing market, but to Ann Arbor, where you really can't get into the market, you know, in Washtenaw County, you can't buy a house for what you can buy in Grand Rapids still. You know what I mean? So housing prices out there are much, I feel like, much higher if you're going to work out of Ann Arbor. So I did need to, I knew I needed to make some money. But our thing, what really made it nice, you know, to say that the sellers were in the driver's seat in this, I felt like for my anxiety level and my husband's, we wanted to get an offer that was solid. Because I think one of the things Michelle talked to me about, and I've heard this from other realtors, is that it's so crazy sometimes. Like, you get offers sight unseen and then they fall through 30 days later because it's somebody who's just trying to get in and just put in a bid as fast as they can on anything because they know it'll pay back, you know? So we wanted to make sure we had a solid offer. So I was lucky enough to get an offer that was, the guy didn't want an inspection, which is fine. The house was built in 2005. I don't think that was a horrible idea, and didn't care about, well, said he would make up the cost if the house didn't appraise. So that made a difference. He also didn't have any contingencies. I mean, not that a lot of our first time, a lot of the offers were first time home buyers, but there were comparable offers to his, but like somebody else's house had to sell before, you know what I mean? Like, it was dependent on that sale. And it made me feel better to know that I didn't have to worry about somebody else's house offer going through. So it just made it really solid. That's what I look for.
You also had a cash offer, but they still wanted an appraisal, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the glory of the cash just went away when you asked for the appraisal. So it was the least risk, the highest price with the least amount of risk.
Strings attached.
Right.
And it wasn't an investor. And that, honestly, that was important to me. I don't know if I would have sold to an investor, even if they did come in with a better offer.
Well, you'll find the whole story spelled out at MichiganRadio.org. Lindsay Smith's reporter's notebook, Cash on the Table for My House, exemplifies Grand Rapids housing boom. Lindsay Smith and Grand Rapids-based realtor Michelle Gordon, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
On tomorrow's Stateside, how one Michigan county makes a lot of money out of foreclosed properties, and one innovative idea that could help homeowners struggling to pay their taxes stay in their houses. That's tomorrow here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Take a Detroit problem. In this case, neighborhoods that have suffered neglect, people who are isolated. Tackle that problem with a solution from a country in the developing world, in this case, Morocco. And that's what an innovative effort called the Ghana Think Tank is doing. And the result is being launched today in Detroit's North End Woodward community. It's called the American Riad, and today marks phase one of this three-year community regeneration project. Here to tell us more is one of the three lead artists on the American Riad. She teaches at George Washington University's Corcoran School of the Arts and Design. Carmen Montoya, pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me today, Cynthia.
Carmen, this Ghana Think Tank premise is really intriguing, helping to solve problems in first world America with solutions from third world countries?
Yes. This project arose from our experiences working on what I'll call the fringes of international development. We really saw the hubris and paternalism of the Western development model, which posits white is right and West is best, and thereby ignores all of the genius of the rest of the world and often causes as much harm as it does good. We wanted to see if there was a way that we could flip this power dynamic in the art context by asking people in the so-called third world to help solve the problems of people living in the so-called first world.
And they work with American-based artists like you?
Yes, there's three of us that are at sort of the U.S.-based facilitators for the project. Myself, Christopher Robbins, and John Ewing. And we met in graduate school when we were studying at Rhode Island School of Design.
Looking at a longstanding problem with fresh eyes is really enlightening. What did the think tank, the people in Morocco, feel about many of the problems that struggling neighborhoods in Detroit are facing?
Well, you know, one of the things that they said to us that was really, really interesting, you know, all of the social factors, of course, and politics and economics, but they said, you also have to think about your architecture. Your culture is obsessed with a single-family home. Your doors are hidden from the street. you know, perhaps you should consider architecture that's more like ours. We have riads where all of the doors open to a central courtyard and there's a shared entrance. You can't help but see your neighbors as they come and go. Something like this can give you community.
So how did that thinking translate into the project that's being launched today in Detroit?
So right now we're working on establishing a Moroccan-style riad in between two buildings on the Euclid Avenue on the north end of Detroit. The idea is that this space will offer cultural programming, so arts, dialogues, skill-sharing programs that help sort of also bring up people's capacity to stay, to succeed, and to thrive in the neighborhood. But we're also very concerned about the gentrifying effects that art can often have, and we're not naive about that. So we've established a community land trust that will create 8 units of residential housing and 6 units of commercial property that people can really own but can't be speculated.
Oh, interesting. So this really, it goes way beyond, quote, an art project. You're really looking to reform the area through arts and culture. And then there's other things that will be offered, home renovation and skill shares in art and setting up people's own systems for water filtration and energy collection.
Well, yes, we're looking at the various problems that people in the neighborhood have presented to us and looking for solutions. So, for example, the problem of access to clean water was something that our one of our think tanks from Indonesia also experiences in their neighborhoods. And so they came here to teach us how to make water filtration systems, and we established a rainwater catchment system as well.
How are the neighbors in the North End reacting to this?
You know, it's really interesting. The neighborhood has only one inhabited house in it right now, or on that block. But people walk by, ride by on their bicycles, and are really interested. And that's one other factor that's super important. It's part of the reason that we're launching now before everything is completed, is that we want people's input early on in the process. We want to hear how people envision the space, what they think about the idea, what kind of programming they would be interested in seeing.
Do you see this going to more neighborhoods? Is this scalable?
It certainly is scalable. It would be wonderful if other people wanted to take up this sort of this process and this concept. We would be totally open to that, absolutely.
Islamophobia is a real issue in this country. I'm wondering what you think it means to be solving an American problem with solutions from a Muslim country.
That's one of the pillars of this project, in that we're really interested in finding a way to respond to Islamophobia by showing how the culture is misunderstood, misrepresented, how the national rhetoric doesn't really enlighten us about the way people live, which is much like the way we live here.
What do you expect the American Riad to mean to this North Woodward community, this North End community, let's say in 5 years' time?
Well, we see it as a place that people can find a voice, have a location that is open and available for programming to meet their own needs. We are going to open with a set of offerings, the Skillshare, the water catchment. We're currently talking to ceramicists in the area about maybe teaching people how to make their own dishware, things that can help sort of spice up their daily lives, right, but also give them skills. But the sky's the limit. We don't know what people are going to ask us for, and we're really looking forward to connecting to those ideas and finding ways to make them reality.
The launch of the American Riad happening today from 5 until 10 this evening. Details at the Facebook page of the Ghana Think Tank. Carmen Montoya is one of the 3 lead artists on the American Riad, working in conjunction with the Ghana Think Tank. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us, Carmen.
Thank you so much for having me today, Cynthia. I really look forward to sharing this work with the people of Detroit.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
To be or not to be? That is the question.
School is letting out, and now it's time for us to plan those summer getaways. Michigan's resort communities are ready to welcome you, and you'll find theater just about
anywhere you go in Michigan. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here now to give us an idea of what is on offer coming up as we start our summers. And David, we're starting over on beautiful Lake Huron shores in Alpena.
That's right. It's a theater called Thunder Bay Theater. It's a beautiful theater, and their season will kick off on June 21st with the Addams Family musical comedy, so something really light.
Ooh, fun. In fact, you know what? Let's take a quick little listen to the fabulous and wonderful Broadway cast recording with the always amazing Nathan Lane as Gomez Addams, just to give everybody an idea of what's in store.
And let us celebrate what it is to be an Addams. When you're an Addams, you need to have a little moonlight. When you're an Addams, you need to feel a little chill. You have to see the world in shades of gray. You have to put some poison in your day.
That's the way when you're an Addams.
You need to have a sense of humor.
So this is clearly, we're in a good mood, it's summer, let's have fun kind of play.
Exactly. You know, hearing that, it reminds me I was offered that part once and I turned it down.
Oh.
So I should have done it. It's so much funny.
Fun. So that starts the summer
at
Thunder Bay.
Yes, Thunder Bay. And then that's followed up there by West Side Story in concert, July 14th through the 16th.
And when that we say in concert, I'm thinking of like the Les Mis concert. So they're standing at microphones.
Right. And there's some acting that
yes.
goes on, but it's really more of a performance of the music.
Okay.
So it's not a full-on production. Mm-hmm. And that'll just go for a few days. But then they do Oklahoma from July 26th to August 13th. And this is one of those theaters, as are a lot of the resort theaters. It's summer stock. So they get some terrifically talented actors who are in university programs mixed in with some veterans.
And when we say summer stock, we've all heard that term. What does it exactly mean?
Well, it means that you sign up with that theater for the summer and they're going to do multiple shows and you're going to get a part in all of them.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Never quite knew what that meant, but now I understand. So you might see, if you come back, you'll see one actor really being versatile.
Exactly. You'll in most cases, you'll see. And in some of these theaters, they actually do, the shows are kind of like overlapping on them and it's a real challenge for actors. Every great actor did summer stock. I mean, I've heard stories, Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda, Tom Hanks, and they learn a lot. You really make your bones doing summer stock.
Very, very fun. Well, let's head over to West Michigan now to Augusta and tell us about the Barn Theater.
The Barn Theater is a terrific theater. They have productions that vie for our Wild Awards every year, and the Wild Awards are like the Michigan Tonys. Augusta is west of Battle Creek and on the west side of Fort Custer State Recreation Area. And they actually have a pretty interesting lineup. They are going to be the first professional theater in Michigan to do a production of the Hunchback of Notre Dame musical, which is a new Disney musical. And for our Ann Arbor listeners, they'll know that Pioneer High School put it on last fall under a very special agreement that they have with Disney. And I might even add that my son actually played the lead as Quasimodo.
So people who you know, grew up watching their kids watch the movie, much like the other Disney theatrical things.
The animated movie. It's of course, based on the Victor Hugo original. But the play tracks the animated movie kind of more closely than it does the original text.
Very, very good.
And then they will also do the Buddy Holly story, a great jukebox piece, starting on June 27th.
And who does not love Saugatuck? So what's happening there?
Well, Saugatuck is another wonderful theater, the Mason Street Warehouse. And they will begin production on Memphis the Musical on June 23rd.
What is that one about? I have not seen that. I mean, I see it pop up on my Broadway and my satellite radio. But what is that about?
It's sort of the Memphis blues scene. And the storyline is actually there's a white producer who kind of has this club that's all – and all the talent is – most of the talent is all African-American.
Okay.
But the music is wonderful. The storyline is very good. I actually saw it at the Croswell a few years ago, and it's terrific, terrific show.
Again, a good feel-good summer, get-you-moving kind
exactly,
of musical.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, now we're going to head to Detroit, where Ernie Harwell lives again at the City Theater right there within the Hockey Town Cafe on Woodward Avenue. And this is Mitch Albom's Ernie, which is going to run now through June 25th.
Yeah, I've seen it. And, of course, Ernie Harwell is a Detroit Tigers announcing legend. Yeah. It's a wonderful story that Mitch put together. It's got a terrific actor, and there's a young kid, and they have this interchange, and it's Ernie really kind of recounting his career. But there's these audio aspects, and there's video visuals, and it's, even if you're not a big baseball fan, it's a terrific show.
I will concur with that, having seen it, and people need to bring their Kleenex, I'll tell you that. Peter Carey plays Ernie Harwell, and T.J. Corbett is the boy. Mm-hmm. And they were here with us on Stateside talking about the play. Here's a little bit from one scene.
Two for the price of one.
I'm sorry?
What you'd say on a double play? Do it, please.
Grounded a Trammell over to Whitaker to Evans. That's two for the price of one.
Yeah, do another.
Strike three looking. He's called out for excessive window shopping.
Yes.
That one is long gone.
Long gone.
Long gone. Like me pretty soon.
I know Peter has told me that he has met after the show with very close members of Ernie's family who will say, wow, it's like seeing him again. It is. It's worth it. And you're right. You don't have to be a sports fan. It's a trip through the 20th century.
It is. And, Ernie, again, he was just one of those landmark personalities that transcends the sport he was associated with.
And David, you've got to look ahead at the upcoming Broadway in Detroit season. We always get some really top-notch shows coming to the Fisher Theater. So what's ahead for the next season?
Yeah, they're great shows. And you can save money and lock these in by doing a subscription if you want. The season starts with Love Never Dies, which is the sequel to Phantom of the Opera, which, of course, huge crowd pleaser. This show is too. That runs in October. Then An American in Paris comes to town late November. I've seen that in New York. Can highly recommend it. The touring show is going to be great. The Bodyguard, based on the movie with Whitney Houston, comes in January. Then Finding Neverland, which is the backstory musical to Peter Pan, that comes in February.
And I will say, I saw that in New York with Matthew Morrison, and it was wonderful.
It is a terrific play. So, one that definitely is a total family experience, School of Rock in April, which is a terrific musical based on the movie, and a musical called On Your Feet, which is about the rise of Gloria and Emilio Estefan, comes after that. It's a tremendous lineup, and I'm always curious about how these folks at Broadway in Detroit go about selecting their season because there's so much to choose from. So I asked Alan Lichtenstein, who's the executive director of Broadway in Detroit, how they go about deciding the mix of shows that we get to see in Detroit.
Well, a lot has to do with availability. These shows tour, and depending on where they start, sometimes they start out the West Coast, sometimes they start at the East. We basically try to bring the most current, most interesting shows in it when we can. And we've had a relationship here in the Fisher since 1961. People love to come to the Fisher. It's one of the great theater towns. It's all about a little luck of the draw. Sometimes you get lucky. We have an excellent relationship with all the producers, and we produce shows ourselves. And we try to put a nice mix together of shows that I think we're going to sell some tickets and that we think that the city should see.
Now, I know a lot of people were going, where's Hamilton? Where's Hamilton? We want Hamilton. And it is worth remembering that the producer of Hamilton is Oakland County and U of M's Jeffrey Seller, who earlier promised, yes, Hamilton will come to Detroit, and that is happening, but...
But not until the 2018-19 season. It'll be early in 19. And, of course, it's been in New York and Chicago, and they're mounting it in L.A., and it's still the hottest ticket anywhere. I saw it in Chicago, and it's an amazing show no matter who's in the cast. I mean, it was wonderful if you got to see the original cast, but the Chicago cast, which is different, was over the top fantastic. And here's what Alan said about how those precious tickets are going to be allocated.
Well, obviously, if you're a season ticket holder, you get first crack at tickets, and also you get to have additional tickets to bring your friends. And so hopefully after all that's done, there's still some tickets left over for the general public.
Hopefully, indeed. Well, so much to think about, and I know we can go, anyone can go to EncoreMichigan.com and get all the particulars of the summer productions that you've talked about and what's ahead.
Yes, there, please come to EncoreMichigan.com. There's a tremendous selection, especially when you factor in all the resort theaters. Mm-hmm. It's just you will not be bored this summer, and don't have to wait for a rainy day either.
David Kiley of Encore Michigan. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I may not live to see our glory.
I may not live to see our glory.
But I've seen wonders great and small.
I've seen wonders great and small.
Because if the tomcat can get married,
if Alexander can get married,
there's hope for our ass after all.
With a glass to freedom.
Hey! Something you will never see again.
No matter what she tells you.
Let's have another round tonight.
Raise a glass to the four of us.
Hey!
To the newly not four of us.
Now we'll tell the story of tonight.
Let's have another round.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for another round of Am I Curious? You ask the question, and we dig up the answer for you. Here's today's question.
I'm Brittany Riley from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I'm curious how the Michigan Liquor Control Commission comes up with the state minimum liquor prices.
Brittany is the general manager of a liquor store in Kalamazoo. Every 3 months, she prints out what she calls a load of price changes that sometimes seem incredibly arbitrary. So, Brittany, let's go straight to the top to get your answer. With us now, the chairman of the Michigan Liquor Control Commission, Andy Deloney. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's break down how it works in Michigan. I own a party store. And what happens when I need to order liquor, beer, and wine? Because I'm wondering, is there any difference among the three?
Yes. The state of Michigan, since the end of Prohibition in 1933, has been the wholesaler of all distilled spirit products in the state of Michigan. Distilled spirits refers to what some people called hard liquor, you know, things like vodka, rum, gin, whiskey, tequila, things like that. So since the end of Prohibition, the state of Michigan, as have many other states around the country, has been the wholesaler of distilled spirits. And in Brittany's question, it's a very good question. The prices are not set by the Liquor Control Commission per se. It is set essentially by state law. State law states that when the state of Michigan purchases a bottle of spirits from the vendor, let's say it's a bottle of vodka, the state of Michigan, by state law, adds three taxes of 4% each. So the three individual taxes of 4% each. And each of the dollars from each of those three taxes goes to different funds in state government. Then by state law, the price is marked up 65%. So that bottle has now been taxed three times at 4% by state law, and by state law, the price has been marked up 65%. That is the price at which the state of Michigan sells the bottle of vodka to the party store owner, the grocery store, the bar, the restaurant, the golf course, the hotel, etc. Now, the price that it is sold to the state of Michigan by is essentially set by the vendor. The vodka maker, the gin maker, the rum maker, the whiskey maker, they essentially decide at what price they want their bottle to appear on the shelf. And, of course, they take into account a number of things they want, and they set the price to the state of Michigan. Now, the Liquor Control Commission in Michigan, we work with the vendors, and we allow for pricing changes up to four times a year currently. So if the maker of a particular whiskey or a gin or rum decides that they want the price of that particular product to change, they can submit a price change to the commission, and we then buy that product at the new price that they set for us. So, again, the price that appears on the shelf has to be a minimum of that taxed and marked up price. The grocery store, the party store, the liquor store owner, they can charge anything above that price, but that taxed and marked up price is the state minimum. That's why oftentimes you'll see on the store windows or inside the stores, you'll see signs or posters or other things that state, we sell at state minimum.
Ah, yes.
What they're trying to say is that The prices for all the spirit products on their shelves, what they're claiming is that those are the minimum prices.
Now, what about beer and wine? How does that work?
Beer and wine is not, the state of Michigan, I should say, is not the wholesaler for beer and wine. So if you are a beer maker, you are a winemaker, you sell that to a private wholesaler. A private wholesaler then sells that to the restaurants and bars and golf courses and party stores and grocery stores, et cetera. But it's a private wholesaler interaction. So the wholesaler, of course, will add their markup for the product or for the process and the service they're providing. And the state law similarly states that the price at which the store or the restaurant or bar bought it from the wholesaler, that has to be the minimum price they sell it to the public. They cannot sell it for below cost. They can sell it for higher than that, but they cannot sell it for below.
Now, why do it this way? Is this, you know, why this minimum price? And certainly we understand taxes go to different state functions, but what's the idea behind this?
The idea behind minimum prices is that we have to remember, according to the advocates, that this is a controlled substance that we're talking about. Alcohol is a controlled substance, and I'm sure we all know, and unfortunately from time to time, sometimes too often, we see the consequences of the overuse, the overconsumption of alcohol, or when alcoholism sets in with a particular individual, the harm that that can cause not only to that individual, but their families, the people around them, and the people on the road who share the roads with people. So the idea behind minimum pricing, according to the advocates, is that, again, keeping in mind that this is a controlled substance. The thought is, if there is minimum pricing, we're not selling alcohol as a loss leader. It makes it just a little bit more difficult to get your hands on the product. But again, at the same time, the state tries to recognize on the other side that it is a legal product and that when enjoyed responsibly, it can be part of a healthy lifestyle that does not lead to harm. So there's that balance that takes place. And of course, every state is different. Under federal law, with the end of prohibition, the 21st Amendment, the United States government, the U.S. Constitution, essentially allows the 50 states the authority to set their own rules and regulations with regard to the taxing and pricing and availability of alcohol.
Got it. Now, how many states are like Michigan with minimum pricing? Do we have a number?
I do not know, but it is a very large number. I do know that.
Do we know if there's any difference in usage in one and prices in the other in the states that do not control minimum prices?
I have not seen any recent research to that effect. However, I do know there's been quite a bit of research. Advocates for minimum pricing point to studies that have been done in the UK in some countries where they do not have minimum pricing, and they will say that the lack of minimum pricing has led to a variety of harms related to the overuse and abuse of alcohol, such as overconsumption by minors, binge drinking, rates of alcoholism, drunk driving, hospitalizations, things like that.
Brittany, we hope this answers your question, and we want to thank Andy Deloney, who's chairman of the Michigan Liquor Control Commission. No better guy to explain Michigan's liquor pricing policies. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
And if you have an Am I Curious question for us to dig into, submit it to us. Go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Any news story about a teen dying by suicide just tears a hole in our hearts. How did it come to this? Were there warning signs? Would I know if my teen struggled with mental health issues and thoughts of suicide? Let's turn to our resident expert, Michigan State University psychiatrist, Dr. Farha Abbasi. Always happy to say welcome to Stateside, Dr. Abbasi.
Thank you, Cindy, though a very hard topic to talk about.
Absolutely. And you stop and you wrap your mind around the fact that suicide is the third leading cause of death among adolescents. The first thing that I think most parents ask ourselves when we hear of a child dying by suicide is, would we know if our child was thinking of suicide? But then you've got that fear that talking about it could plant a seed and lead to it. What is your take on that fear?
One thing I would really like to emphasize here is talking about is never a trigger. Actually, it is highly recommended because these kids tend to isolate and would hide, would not like to talk about it openly. So that's a myth that talking about suicide is a risk.
Dr. Abbasi, let's talk about the warning signs that parents and friends and teachers should know about, both the subtle, maybe earlier signs and those clear signs of imminent danger. Can you break those down into those two groups?
Key word here is sudden changes of behavior. So let's say somebody was very outgoing, very social, suddenly have started losing interest in academic work, not showing up for classes, isolating, not hanging out with friends. Or in this age group, of course, we know this is the first time you're experimenting with drugs. So what if somebody is start to drink excessively or trying to indulge into marijuana or other drugs, you know, beyond experimentation, using it excessively? Other thing is sleep patterns change. So like sleeping excessively, a kid who was highly energetic, suddenly struggling to come out of bed. Or it can go the other way. Somebody who loved sleeping is suddenly not sleeping enough. But the biggest red flags become if they start talking in very absolute terms, like, I'm a burden, but you won't have to put up with me anymore. Or start giving away their love, like prized possessions. That is a key thing, like giving away their collection, their poster collections, car collection, stuff like that. Cleaning the room, becoming very organized. Those could be signs to look out for. Of course, we still know that the biggest suicide that is completed is through firearms. So again, that becomes very imperative that they do not have access to firearms. That still is a big risk.
Can you give us some language, things that parents could say to help us broach this with our kids? Like, what are the do's and don'ts about talking about suicide with our teens?
I'm a big proponent of talking. But of course, like with any communication, any conversation you have with your colleague, with anyone, there is rules of respect, of trust, of feeling safe. All those have to be applied when you're talking to your kids. You just cannot assume this tone of like, I know better, or I'm your father or mother. Do what I'm saying. Right now, we are big on creating trauma-informed care, right? And the big notion in trauma-informed care is you never go in with saying, what is wrong with you? You always start the conversation with what wrong happened to you. Mm-hmm. So be it bad behavior, bad grades, starting the conversation there, that what is going on with you, what is happening around you, how are you interacting with your friends? We just assume that they are hanging out and so they are fine. But really sitting them down and talking to them like, okay, who are you hanging out with? What kind of activities are you involved in? How are you doing academically? So not only just pushing a GPA, but the learning, the education. Again, safety, trust, respect. In the end, if you cannot be a safe place for your kids, then they will seek it out other ways of coping with it.
Dr. Abbasi, what do parents need to understand about the world their kids are living in right now in 2017 that's different from the world mom or dad grew up in?
This is an age of instant information. They have access to much more than we ever had hoped to know. And things are changing really fast. So with every privilege, advantage, there comes more hazards and side effects too. Too much exposure on social media has also become a source of cyberbullying, peer pressuring. There is this group mentality, the herd mentality. And if you do not fit in, then more chances that your self-esteem and sense of inadequacy would be heightened. Kids have more exposure to drugs now. Kids are experimenting with sexual stuff more early on that we know. But the other thing is, of course, we have to be very cognizant and supportive of our kids who are struggling with sexual orientation or having gender identity issues. Those are the most vulnerable youth still. Then there are issues like minorities, then gender issues. Girls are more vulnerable than boys to indulging in these behaviors. So I think we as parents go in with the mindset that this generation has easier than we had it. It's the other way around. I do feel the pressure and stresses on the kids these days is much more. And when we were growing up, high school used to be a big thing. Then going to college was the ultimate thing. Look at right now, the message the kids are getting is nothing, like even being a graduate is the goal. Hmm. but then there are no resources available, then there is so much consumerism around these kids. If we look at teenagers, the age group, this is the time when you are developing an identity. So it is definitely fraught with a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of sense of inadequacy. The kids are have more exposure, they are wiser, but we also need to understand how best to provide these resources and guide them in a positive way.
What have you found, Dr. Bossi, to be the most effective ways that you as a psychiatrist can treat suicidal thoughts in young people?
In some cases, the kids can be contemplating it for a while. In some cases, we see it becomes very impulsive behavior. So first thing is keeping the communication open. If they are depressed or anxious, giving them the right treatment, getting them into therapy, having family conversations, bringing that support in. Lastly, I think the most important thing becomes a sense of self-worth, self-resiliency, self-coping, all that becomes really important. Knowing what to turn to and where to access this help. So I would give them resources and talk to them how, if they are feeling impulsive, how can they talk to themselves, self-soothe themselves to walk through that few seconds of impulsive behavior. You know, there is this national suicide hotline that I always give the number to the kids.
I think that's very important because parents might not know exactly what to do and where they should turn. And so what would be that first resource?
So it's a suicide hotline, crisis line, and 1-800-273-TALK.
1-800-273-TALK. That's easy to remember.
Right. And what we are finding out, Cindy, which is really concerning, that if a kid is talking about suicide, indulging in self-harming behavior, or calling these crisis line, there are 30% chances, higher chances, that they would at some point complete the suicidal behavior. So this is a very red flag sign that if a kid is talking about it, to take it seriously, assure them, give them resources, provide a network of support system around them. It could be family, it could be friends, it could be therapists, it can be school system has to play an extremely important part because these age group kids are spending more time in school than at home. Bullying has become a big problem in school system these days. And the kids who are exposed to bullying, there's more higher chances for them to contemplate suicide or attempt or complete. Mm-hmm. So involving the teachers, school counselors, creating safe environment at school, identifying people they can easily talk to, all that becomes very important.
Finally, Dr. Bossi, as a therapist, what do you want moms and dads to know about the process of therapy? Say that their youngster is seeing someone like you, a psychiatrist, or they're seeing a psychologist. What's the parent's role in all of this?
It comes back to stigma around mental illnesses, that we always thought that if we validate that the kid is feeling depressed or anxious, or if we take them to therapy, we somehow are putting a label on our kids. I think for the parents, they should understand that it is imperative if a kid is depressed, anxious, that therapy is beneficial. And therapy should not be taken like, okay, only the kid needs it. It should be like anything else, family activity, family concern, because the kids are reflective of what is happening within the homes. They are not acting out in isolation or in vacuum. Usually, if the kids are acting out or showing signs, then something is happening within the household, and that becomes the responsibility of the parents equally.
And once again, that suicide hotline number that Dr. Abbasi recommends is 1-800-273-TALK. MSU psychiatrist Dr. Farah Abbasi, always good to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.